How do you feel when somebody does something for you, but they do a terrible job? Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever had that happen? Someone does something for you and they can't wait to do it for you. And so you've almost in some sense of anticipation before they do it. It's like, wow, they're going to do this for me. And then they do a terrible job. And you're kind of like got that sinking feeling in your gut. Like, you know, wow. I mean, like, couldn't you have cared a little more, made a little more effort? Or someone says something like, you know, I this happens around my house sometimes. Somebody says, I'll wash that cup for you. And then you put the cup up to your lip. And just before you're about to take a drink, you smell someone else's bad breath. Or you still smell milk in the glass. And you look, and now your water is cloudy. And you think to yourself, they didn't wash that out. They didn't do a good job of that at all. The reason I said we had a whole lot of people in our house for the last, we had like 16 people in our house for like 2 weeks straight. And when you have that many people in the house and different people washing dishes, several times I picked up a glass this week and went, oh, please just don't wash dishes if you're going to do that. Don't you love it when people offer to massage your shoulders as you're watching TV and then after like 5 seconds they get lost in the movie and forget about you? Or one of my favorites, I remember one time when I could still eat lasagna, someone promising to make me a homemade lasagna, and then when I got to their house, it was Stouffer's. Ever ordered maybe steak for your birthday, and then you get hamburgers? You ask for an iPod, and you get this generic MP3 player that breaks in 2 weeks. Then make your favorite chocolate chip cookies, but you hate nuts. And then they put nuts in them because they're for you. Maybe you feel guilty then, a little dumped on by their kindness. It feels half done or insincere. You hate to complain because they spent time and energy, and maybe even money, but it seems like they didn't listen, didn't care, or like they did whatever they wanted to do regardless of what you were wanting. I want you to hang on to those emotions for just a moment as we read today about King Saul and consider his worship that he offered to God as we continue our series on finishing well. Take a look here. 1 Samuel chapter 13, verses 1 through 15. I'm going to be reading in the English Standard Version. Please read along in whatever translation you have in your lap. That's my favorite translation, the one that you're reading. Or you can follow along on the screens overhead if you would prefer. 1 Samuel chapter 13. And so Saul lived for a year and then became king. And then when he had reigned for 2 years over Israel, Saul chose 3,000 men of Israel. By the way, just a footnote. No, it's not saying that Saul was 1 year old when he became king and 2 years old when he picked an army. Just clarifying that, okay? So, and 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan and Gibeah of Benjamin, and the rest of the people he sent home, every man to his tent, and Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba, and the Philistines heard of it, and Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all of Israel heard it and said that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines so that all Israel had become a stench to the Philistines. And the people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal, and the Philistines mustered to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and troops like the sand of the seashore in multitude. And they came up and encamped at Michmash to the east of Beth Avon. And when the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, for the people were hard pressed, the people hid themselves in caves and in holes and in rocks and in the tombs and in cisterns. And some Hebrews crossed the fords of the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. And Saul was still at Gilgal, and all the people following him were trembling. And he waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, "Bring the burnt offering here to me and the peace offering." And he offered the burnt offering. And as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to greet him and said, and Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "Well, when I saw the people were scattering from me and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash, I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. And Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God for which he commanded you. For then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. And Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal, and the rest of the people went after Saul to meet the army, and they went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. Smells like defeat, doesn't it? What I want you to understand at this point, I know that it's sometimes a little confusing when you're reading through the biblical record, because like any storyline, they don't like detail every single thing that happens. They give you points in time that are important and significant. Saul was king over Israel for a total of 40 years. He was 72 when he died. His coronation was when he was 30. Now, the opening verses in this chapter tell us that Saul was anointed king by Samuel a full year before he was installed as king of Israel. So last week when we were reading in chapter 10, we were looking at chapter 10, and it was talking about those events and how the people came out and celebrated Saul being king. It had been a full year from the time that he had been prophesied over and told that he was going to be king to the time that he got to actually celebrate becoming king. And even then, the celebration was kind of questionable. Remember, he was hiding in the baggage. If you want to hear, just letting you know, Saul, the future king of Israel. Well, amen. Okay, so Saul, the future king of Israel, was hiding in the baggage. And he was not ready to be king in a number of ways in terms of emotionally. But God called him out and the people rallied around him. And they coronated him as king. And then he went back home. And it took him 2 full years before he appointed an army. At this point, where we're looking right now, the best hypothesis is we are halfway through his rule as king. It is about 20 to 25 years later from where we read in chapter 10 to where we're reading now in chapter 13. You say, wow, why does it jump so quickly that many years? Nothing to tell. He was a lackluster, incompetent king. There's nothing to tell. There's no great victories. Instead, what you read into the story is simply this, that they've been plagued by war and by hardship ever since he's become king. Now they're to the point, it says, there's not even a blacksmith. They can't even go get their plowshares sharpened or anything else. They have to go down to the Philistines and ask permission, because the Philistines have got their foot on their neck so badly. They have killed all their blacksmiths. There are no blacksmiths left in Israel. Israel is in a desperate situation because Saul is king. Remember, before Saul was king, they were prospering under Samuel. No wars had come to their shore. No wars. Nobody was marching against them. Everybody was afraid of them. And they never had to raise an army. And they were prospering as a nation. They had everything that they needed, except they wanted a king. And God warned them, if your king does not have a heart that's after my own heart, if you do not continue to pursue me as you pursued me under Samuel, I will not bless this. You have rejected me as your king. And you will reap just what you asked for. You asked for it, you get it. And they said, we know, give us a king, give us a king. And then he's hiding the baggage and they go, yay, let's go get him and take him by force to make him our king. Can I just say something here? If you're depending on a king to save you and he is hiding in the baggage when he is a full head taller than everybody else, you don't want that guy to be your king to take you into battle. Hello? It's not going well. We're just two chapters later. Why? Because there's nothing to tell you in between except it's been bad. There's just nothing to report other than he's a bad king. He's not capable. He had wealth. He had ability. He had physical ability. God had changed his heart. There was every reason for Saul to succeed. And yet, what we're going to see, what we see right here is why he didn't. King David, just for reference, King David was born about the 10th year of Saul's reign. So David was anointed king in his early 20s and then lived in exile for the last 8 years of Saul's reign before ascending to the throne at around age 30. My point being this, that all indications are that Saul had been king long enough that he knew the protocols of sacrifice. He knew the limits of his own authority as king, which were quite vast, but not to offer sacrifice. From the time between his coronation and this judgment is not a rash action. 20 to 25 years have passed. He knows what he's doing. And so do not get the idea in the middle of this that Samuel or God in their response to him are being harsh. They have 20 to 25 years of dealing with this guy as king. They've got 20 to 25 years of all his posturing, his political role playing, and everything else. And this point, they come to this point and he goes, well, you know, I didn't want to go into battle without seeking the favor of God. And Samuel's not having any of it, and neither is the Lord. They don't believe him. Remember, the thing is about the Lord that he searches and knows the hearts of men. It's not like God was just looking at the outside and going, well, I don't know. Maybe he really meant to do the right thing, and I should just forgive him. I don't know everything. God, who knows everything and searches the hearts and the minds of men, looked at this situation and spoke through the prophet Samuel and said, you're done. It's just one more example in his entire reign of how not to be king. Now, the whole deal is here is that we could look at it and we could go, well, you know, Saul saw his, you know, men running, and we could just play that kind of poor me card. He saw the men running. Of course, let's think about why they're running. There is a gigantic army on the other side who is ready to crush them. There's a gigantic army that has just had one of their small garrisons defeated, and they are out to teach these upstart Israelites a lesson. And so they're coming out to not to defeat them, but to crush them, to make sure that they don't ever try that again. They have seen both times where they have dominated Israel and times where they were unable to touch Israel. And so now that Israel's had one defeat, beaten them one time, they're thinking to themselves, this is probably not a good idea to let this continue. Last time they had they were able to overcome us, and then Samuel came as judge, and we were unable to touch them for the entire time that Samuel was judge. Let's don't let that get a chance to get started. Let them get a chance to get confidence in God. Let's make sure that we defeat them soundly before they do what they did the last time and turn their face toward God and expect him to deliver them, and he should come against us. So Saul did what any good politician would do. He called on the name of God. Hello? Isn't it what politicians do when the moments are tense and difficult? They call on the name of God, invoke the presence of God, the power of God, and they stir us up to patriotism with religious fervor that you've never seen demonstrated by them at any other time. It's eye-opening, church. It's one of the things that we ought to, as the church, be very wary of. But I'm sure that never happens to us. Now, In the midst of this, ruling and reigning and him calling on this, it doesn't work. You see, he calls on the name of God and all this, but the truth is that his heart is now very far from God. While his reign promised peace and prosperity, it's riddled with war. When Israel had peace before he came to the throne, Israel has no peace. Where they were prospering, they have no prosperity. Where they had blacksmiths, they have no blacksmiths. All under this. And if you look at the whole way that this begins to unfold throughout the history of 1 Samuel, we begin with Eli the priest, who was judge and priest, and he lives a life that is clearly, a mess. By the time we come into the situation, his sons are behaving badly. He's doing nothing about it. He's letting them eat the things that are forbidden for them to eat. He's allowing them to behave badly and take bribes. He's hearing that they're sleeping with the women at the gate out of for favors and things like that. And all he says is, now you shouldn't be doing that, but he makes no effort to do anything about it. Along comes Samuel. Samuel loves the Lord. He is devoted to God. He spends all of his time sleeping, not where it's comfortable, but sleeping beside the ark of God because he wants to be near the presence of God. He is a person of moral character and integrity. He is a person who is devoted to God. And he spends some 20 years convincing the people after the death of Eli that they need to turn their hearts toward God. And never does he say, I will do just what you want me to so that I can be the judge. And finally, the people realize that they can't take what's happening to them. And they go, okay, Samuel, what do we have to do to get God back on our side? He says, real easy. I will sacrifice and offer worship for you, and you must destroy your Baals, your Ashtaroth. You must turn from all the other gods and turn your hearts fully to God. And when you stop being duplicitous, when you stop all this other stuff of honoring God on one hand and then chasing all these other gods, when you stop consulting God and your horoscopes, when you stop consulting God and having the magic wishing stone, when you stop consulting God and you just fill in the blank, because there's any number of things that people do and wonder why that God doesn't respond well. God says, I'm a jealous God. I will have no other gods before me. He doesn't want to play second fiddle to your horoscope. He doesn't want to play second fiddle to your tarot cards or anything else. Some people might say, well, that seems silly. Why is he bringing that up? Because I know for a fact it happens here. Hello? So we have this kind of this whole thing where he's saying, put away all of that. And they did. And God responds to them and they're blessed. They didn't even need an army. And now, here they are in this mess. And we're about to, in the next chapter or two, paint this amazing contrast, not between Eli and Samuel, but now between two kings, between David and Saul. And while David's life was not perfect, neither was Samuel's life. But the great contrast was in who they were in pursuit of, who they were deeply in love with. You see, the thing is that when you and I are walking with God, it's not that you and I are going to get everything right all the time. Have you figured that part out? I have figured that part out. It's taken me a while. I thought at some point that someday I would just be so holy. I couldn't, I would just and then reality sat in. And sometimes there are days when I sit and weep over myself and go, God, when do I stop being like this? And start being like that. And just very lovingly said, it's okay, son. When they close the lid on the box, you'll be fine. Seriously, we don't get it all right. We don't. But the contrast, when we look at the life of David and we look at the life of Samuel, is not that they get everything right, is that their hearts are for God continually. Even when they fall, when they make mistakes, they are willing to be held accountable. David, even at his worst, ugliest fall with adultery and murder and everything else, finally in the end, holds himself accountable and recognizes that what happens from in future generations is the fault of his behavior early on. He's not absolved, nor does he expect to be. But continually he pursues with his heart after God, even in his foolishness, even in his failings. The same is true with Samuel. The difference is that Eli, when God rebukes him, he doesn't repent. He just says, it's God's will. Let him do whatever he wants. And then he just lets his family suffer the consequences without ever making any serious attempt to stop it. And what we find here in the life of Saul is the kind of thing that we see over and over again from now on out, the rest of Saul's life as we watch those last few years. That's when we get all the most reporting about Saul is as his kingdom crumbles down around his ears and he pursues David to kill him in order to protect his power, his pride, and his position. Our main focus is this: Saul's disobedience. You and I could say that he was trying to do something right and that he offered the sacrifice. We might find a way in our hearts to justify his actions, and we could assume the best about Saul, that he really wanted God to be with them. I'm sure he wanted God to be with them and for God not to be against them. Would you bet that too? I mean, when was the last time you heard somebody say, I really want God to be against me? So I'm certain that he did want God to be with him and all this, but it's really not a gray area. It was really quite black and white here, the line in the sand, that this was not an offering that he was allowed to do. It's nothing he'd been allowed to do before. It's nothing that would have been allowed for any other people. Other people had fallen dead from trying to do this. And he chooses what is personally expedient at the moment. So if we should try to justify Saul, I want you to think about what it feels like when people don't keep their word and when they act seemingly compliant, obedient, or do something out of friendship, but in reality, they do whatever they want to do, regardless of what's promised, and ask yourself how that feels. On some small scale, we're talking about washed dishes and chocolate chip cookies, not about doing what is right before God. And I know how that makes me feel. The degree of frustration, of disappointment. But we're not talking about cookies and unwashed glasses. We're not talking about back rubs that fade out after a couple of minutes. We're talking about willfully doing whatever you want to do and then telling God, and by the way, would you bless it? The call on Saul's life was to be a king whose heart was after God. It was very clearly spoken to him. It was given to him in a prophetic word. Back in chapter 9 and chapter 10, it was conferred upon him again through multiple prophetic actions and words that were given to him. It was conferred to him by the city, by the nation. It was conferred to him in his second coronation two years after he had already been king. And the people kept doing everything to confirm that to him. And continually the message was given over and over again that he was not just to be king, but that he was to be a king whose heart was after God. What's the call on your life? What's the call on your life? Let me tell you something. There is no less call on your life to be a banker, teacher, real estate agent, waiter, maintenance worker whose heart is after God. There's no less call on your life. You and I are called to be whatever it is with our hearts after God. But here's the thing. When you're king, it's not just this sphere of influence or this sphere of influence. It's this sphere of influence. See, some of us are, we have about 10 people in our sphere of influence. There's the people that we work with and our immediate family and things like that, that we affect by the things that we do and say, and we have an effect on them. We have influence over them. And when we are the kind of banker, real estate person, a teacher, whatever we are, and we do or don't do, we have an immediate effect on them, but not usually a whole lot further than that. Some of us have greater influence. We have influence over whole schools or whole banking institutions, or maybe it's a business that we own or whatever else. And how we behave begins to affect not just 10 people, but 50 people, or maybe it's 100 people. Maybe it's 1,000 people. We have different spheres of influence that and how we affect people. But the king affects everyone. And so in his attitude, he doesn't just simply offend God as if that weren't enough. But before a whole nation, he just does what is politically expedient, and he teaches an entire nation. It doesn't really matter what you do concerning God. He'll bless you anyhow. You can do whatever you want. It's a message he's inadvertently communicating. I don't care what God's word says. It was the time people were leaving me. My army was shrinking, and I had to do what was best for me in the moment. Really, what was best? Saul, go home. Saul, wait for Samuel. Saul, trust God. Wait for the right day, the right time, the right moment. Pray to God and ask him to be with you in spite of things. But don't decide that you will give God whatever you want to give him. Do it in your own way and then say, hey, God, and would you bless what I'm doing? But oftentimes it's how people do life or even ministry. We simply put together ideas. And then we say, hey, God, by the way, would you bless this? That fleeting prayer. Hey, God, I've already decided that I'm going to buy this house. I've already decided I'm going to go to this college. I've already decided I'm going to marry this person. Oh, by the way, God, would you bless this? And then when he doesn't, we go, I don't know where God was in that. Man, I can't depend on God. God isn't trustworthy. God never comes through. Really? Really? Did God fail to come through? Or did we just ask God to bless what we were already doing? So for you and I, the goal is not for you and I to be king, unless maybe that is the call on your life, in which that's really interesting, you live, being born in the United States. The goal is not for you to be the high priest. It is, however, for you to be the priest of your home, but the goal is for you and I to be the best whatever whose heart is after God, so that when you and I do our job, when we invoke the name of God, that it is because we have sought his face and know his heart, not as a cover for our evil or a cover for our sloppiness or an excuse to do a lesser job or to justify us in manipulating the outcome. When you and I call on the name of God in the workplace, it ought to be only to honor him for a job well done. Thank you. Yes, you know, I was really struggling with how I was going to do that, and I just have to give God the credit. I was lost in what to do next, and God gave me this idea, and I followed it through, and God gave me strength whenever I was really tired and I wasn't going to get it done and things like that. You give God the glory for excellence, for compassion, for integrity, for all of those things, but we don't just use God at the water cooler as a way to browbeat an unbeliever, to wage political war at the water cooler. It should not be to justify anything or anyone. Church, the only time that people ought to hear the name of God from our lips is when we give him glory and honor, not to invoke his name as a cover for our own actions or the lack of our own ability to win an argument. Can I tell you that it's really a damaging thing to the church when we go out and we argue with people who don't agree with us, and then in the last moment, because we can't win the argument any other way, and we say, well, God says it's in the Bible. And one more time, they just write off the Church of Jesus Christ as irrelevant, foolish, stupid. And we dishonor the name of God. You want to draw people's attention in the workplace? Do an excellent job and then give God the credit for that. Don't give him credit for your badly made arguments. Don't give him credit for your political party. Because I can tell you that there isn't a political party in the United States that I can side with 100%. And you shouldn't be able to either. Uh-oh, he's gone to meddling now. When we invoke God's name for the things that we do well, when we do things with excellence, it brings glory and honor to God. But when we invoke God's name to win arguments or to win a political position or to ask people to sign on to something just because we're against something or for something, when we do just what Saul did and we do what is expedient in the moment and we invoke God's name in it, we dishonor God. We don't honor him. And then, of course, there's this whole thing of vain worship. I mean, think about this. From some point, we have to ask ourselves about the authentic nature of worship. Why is it that he thinks so little of worshiping God that he's willing to offer God something less than what God has asked for him? It's as if he was just kind of like rubbing the lamp in hopes of getting what he would want out of the genie. You know, and a lot of times we do the same thing with God. God loves us. He desires our affection and worship. He defeated sin and death through his son, Jesus. But does God get the worship from our hearts that touches his heart? Or does he get just what we feel like? Whatever entertains us, whatever we're willing to do. Does God ever get us out of our comfort zones where we kneel down, fall on our faces, lift our hands, or do the things that are completely out of our comfort zone simply because he is worthy? Simply because we love him and we honor him above ourselves? Simply because that as I read my Bible, I find where he talks about lifting of hands and getting on my knees and fasting and praying. And what I want to do more than anything is to please him, not just to worship him as an expediency to get what I want or to improve my family or to improve my work life or anything else. God is not your home improvement plan. He is the almighty and everlasting God who is worthy of our worship and our honor, whether it ever goes my way or not. And when it goes my way, he deserves all the praise and honor for that too. So let's wrap this up. Let me ask you, as a follower of Jesus, you know, part of finishing well is making sure that God gets the credit, the glory for the good things that I do. So ask yourself, when and where, besides church, does God get the glory for your gifts, your talents, your success? And I don't mean in a false sense of humility where we just say, well, boss, I don't know if I could have typed that email without the presence of God working in my life today. Okay, that might seem a little shallow after a while. After about the 10th email of the day, your boss might be looking at you going, can you just type the email? Could you just do that? Bob is typing the email. Jerry, can you just type the email without having to tell me that, you know, you typed one more email to the glory of God, okay? You might be missing the point at that juncture. But whenever I do something that's tough, hard, whatever else, and I'm getting praise, my boss doesn't come in and say to me, you know, Wow, that was a great email. But sometimes they do say, I can't get over how you put together that event in such short notice. I love the way you thought up that new process and how it's making a difference in our company. I love the way that you teach, and we're watching your students get higher and higher scores on their SAT. If the boss says, well done, does God get the glory? Does anyone know the difference between the fact that you were praying and seeking God for strength and wisdom? Did you? Does he have any relevance in our day-to-day life beyond Sunday morning? And worship. What kind of worship does God get from you and I? Not just in here. It's so easy to reduce worship to a few songs in communion, maybe even listening to that guy talk on stage. But you know, Hebrews makes it really clear that real worship is something that we do all the time. It's a way that we give our lives over to him, that we crawl, as it were, on the altar and become a living sacrifice, that our entire lives become expended, spent on the things of God and his kingdom to advance his causes, to advance his church in the world, to advance the spreading of the gospel, to advance his kingdom, his rule and his reign over everything. That is real worship. And so the place of authentic worship isn't just what we do here on Sunday morning, but it's what you do when you're talking to your coworker. It's what you do at the grocery store when you're buying your groceries and you decide how that you're going to treat the clerk in the checkout line. It's the difference of how you treat the waiter that comes up to your table. See, I remember getting lectured really severely over the issues of homosexuality by a group of people one time and some of my views. And then I watched them treat with utter contempt the person who was waiting on us at our table. And I was dismayed at what I saw. And I did everything in my power and gave that person the biggest tip I could, because that was a human being created in the image of God standing across the table from us who did not deserve to be treated like dirt because you don't like the way they speak or their lisp or the way they move their hands or whatever else. That is a human being created in the image of God. And worship, or the lack thereof, was expressed in how that person left our table that day, a table full of pastors. Church, if we're going to finish well, this can't be all there is to worship. Our lives have to be about glorifying him in the grocery line and at the checkout counter and in the schools and the relationships you have with friends and family and even the people you don't like, even that neighbor who flips you the bird when he leaves his trash in your yard, even the person who pulls up behind you and tailgates you all the way to the next town and then goes past you and doesn't wave with all of his fingers. Even the person who's rude to you or unkind to you, or the garbage man who dumps your trash in your yard every time. I'm not saying you have to be a doormat. I'm just saying, does the way that you live your life bring glory and honor to God? Or are we doing just what Saul did in convenient moments, calling on him when we need help, asking him to rescue us when it's convenient, and invoking his name to win our arguments, to win our fights, to position ourselves? And I can tell you that's how Saul lost the kingdom. Church, you and I are giving our lives for the sake of a kingdom that does not perish, and that isn't defined by borders. Let's stand together.